Jeff Timmer is former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Mark Brewer is former chair of the Michigan Democrats. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer, and this is a republic if you can keep it. In a few minutes, Mark Brewer and I will be joined by former Ohio Democratic Party chair David Pepper, author of the new book, Laboratories of Autocracy. We begin, as always, with the politics of the past week. And Mark, we had some big success with the Biden administration passing a bipartisan infrastructure bill in Washington just as we headed into the weekend. I think I'd love to get your thoughts on how this affects the politics as we head into 2022.
It was a real up and down week in American politics last week, particularly for Democrats. Lost the governorship of Virginia, nearly lost the governorship of New Jersey. And then the president comes back from the global summit, and I think it could have gone either way. I think people could have read into what happened on Tuesday, well, this is too much. We can't spend this kind of money. We had a revolt against it on Tuesday. But instead, it went the opposite way. And the president, I think, really stepped up. I mean, I think the Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Schumer have been working very hard on this, particularly Pelosi. I just can't tell you how much I admire her, but that's another day. But the president really stepped up when he got back and really showed a lot of leadership. He had been letting things kind of go, let them work it out. I'm not going to interfere. He really pushed when he got back. And we saw the success then, finally, with a handful of Republicans supporting it, including some now, including our own Congressman Upton, who's been threatened as a result, and a handful of Democrats who didn't go along because they still want the bigger package to be passed at the same time. But this was an enormous success for the Biden presidency. I mean, this is the biggest infrastructure package since at least the Interstate Highway Act of the 50s, trillions and trillions of dollars. It's going to clean up our water, build new bridges, build new highways, fix railroads. I mean, it's extraordinary what's in this package. But as you and I have talked about, Democrats have been so caught up in process fights for the last several months, and they took a beating for it. And I think it hurt us in Virginia and New Jersey. The fact that we spent months and months talking about, well, I want this, I want that, blah, 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 rather than what's in the package. So anyway, it was great, but now the burden is on my party to do something we don't do very well, which is go out and talk about what's in the package so that not only is it good policy, but that Democrats and the president get credit for it as these billions and billions of dollars roll out over the next, I think it's going to start even within the next few months, and of course over the next several years. And we really start to see a significant investment in our infrastructure. So, again, a real up and down week, but in a really, really high note that I hope Democrats will take advantage of.
What's interesting, too, I mean, I think that's a great analysis. You mentioned the 13 Republicans in the House who voted for it and the blowback that they're getting, including Fred Upton here in Michigan, who's been getting vile physical and death threats and recorded voicemails. But what's kind of been lost is that 40% of the Republicans in the Senate voted for this package. It really is bipartisan. It's not just a token, small number. 13 out of 213 in the House might sound like a small number. It shows you how friggin' nuts most of the House Republicans are, that they're voting against spending millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in their own states and their own districts on things that usually have achieved some great level of bipartisanship, that those infrastructure, roads, bridges, clean water, those kinds of things, drinking water. Not only did Biden achieve one of the promises he made to try to work collaboratively with the other side, even when I think most of the evidence is you can't negotiate with terrorists, and that's what the Republicans have largely been when it comes to anything legislatively in Washington, let alone their actual support of terrorism. But he did achieve a significant level of bipartisanship and delivered his the Democrats, his fellow Democrats, in the significant numbers. You know, I saw tweets all day on Friday from the Republican big mouths about how Pelosi doesn't have the votes. Pelosi doesn't have the votes. This is all going to crash. This is all going to crash. Wrong.
Right.
People have been underestimating Joe Biden for a long time, certainly since he entered the presidential race in, you know, 2019. He's been counted out. He came back, won that nomination. He was counted out. He won the presidency. I've seen enough evidence to show me don't count Joe Biden out. He knows how to move the levers in Washington. The big question is going to be, I have no doubt that he's going to be able to move significant legislative levers. Can the Democrats, though, can from the White House on down, this includes Biden, can they change their messaging strategy and tactics? Can they start to compete with Republicans when it comes to messaging? Because at the end of the day, I don't think 2022 elections are going to be decided with a policy pen or a list of, incumbent accomplishments. I think it's going to be a holy hell culture war, and the Democrats today aren't prepared to fight that.
Yeah, no, you made that point before, and I think you're right. But I love your point about the bipartisan nature of this. Thank you for reminding us. Mitch McConnell voted for this bill when it passed in the Senate. And Biden and the Democrats accomplished something that Trump spent 4 years trying to do. In fact, I think the first thing out of Biden's mouth when he made the announcement was, it's finally infrastructure week, which had become a joke during the course of the Trump administration. But you're right. The bipartisanship is going to be forgotten. There's going to be a bipartisan signing ceremony probably next week. And there should be. There should be. There were Republicans who supported this, and it's important to do that. But you're right. We are in the middle of a massive culture war, whether it's about CRT and all the stuff around vaccination.
Sesame Street.
Yeah. You know, you've got people like Ted Cruz attacking cultural icons like Big Bird. Over vaccinations. I mean, there's just nothing that seems to be sacred anymore. And you're right, next year it's going to be about that and making sure that Democrats not only counter it, but as you pointed out, counter and pivot to talk about issues. I mean, one of the big things that happened last week as well was the argument in the United States Supreme Court over the Texas abortion law, the vigilante law. It looks like there may be a couple of the conservative justices, a couple of the Trump appointees, Kavanaugh and Barrett, who aren't comfortable with that law. And so maybe in the end it falls, but still waiting in the wings is the big case out of Mississippi in which they could overturn Roe. If that happens, I think next year's election could turn in large part on choice. And I know that Gretchen Whitmer and Dana Nessel have already been talking about that. And they're certainly going to do so. And it's unfortunate that that whole issue is going to get politicized, but it's going to. And better to be on the right side of that, making sure that we don't have extreme laws which criminally penalize women and abortion providers, like the current Michigan statute that is basically not in effect because of Roe, but it'll come back into effect if Roe gets overturned. So, I'm just kind of gone off on a little tangent here about one aspect of the cultural wars that I think Democrats can hold the high ground on. But as you pointed out, Jeff, so frequently, by making sure that we don't take an extreme position on it, that we fight the extreme positions of the Republicans on issues of choice, et cetera, but not embrace an extreme position ourselves.
What this underscores, though, Mark, is this: the tendency to try to, our default position is kind of sanity. Okay, we want to have normal debate. We want to have normal politics. We want to look at this and say, okay, we want to debate the up and down merit. We can have a legitimate disagreement on the size of a spending bill. That's not abnormal in American politics. What is abnormal is now you have Kevin McCarthy and others in the House Republican Conference in Washington threatening to remove, or there's people pushing to have those 13 Republicans stripped of their committee assignments. You've got Matt Gaetz, who's been credibly accused, about to be indicted for statutory rape. You've got Marjorie Taylor Greene. You've got Paul Gosar, who's putting out videos of animation of him killing the president and other members of Congress. There's not a peep about discipline for any people like that. It underscores how just off balance, out of whack. The sense of right and wrong is with the Republican Party as a whole right now. And so while our tendency is to kind of still look at things in a normal prism, that we fail to grasp when we do that, that the other side is living in the upside down world. It's like Alice in Wonderland. And that's what we need to fight. We can't just go out and have a campaign conversation where they're screaming at the top of their lungs about something crazy. And we say, oh, that's crazy. Everybody knows that's crazy. They don't know it's crazy. We have to, we can't just take the, when they go low, we go high. We have to be able to compete in that arena with that rhetoric, not saying to be crazy, but we have to compel people in an emotional way, not just in a rational, intellectual way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Jeff. I mean, look, who thought at the time that what they did to Liz Cheney was going to become the pattern? But that was really, they're going to do this. And they did it to her, and now they're doing it to these other members as well. They're on this real vendetta. But I think one of the problems is, and I don't disagree with your approach, is that I think the American people are just exhausted. They're exhausted of the pandemic. They're exhausted from Trump. And everybody wants to, like, let's get back to normalcy, right? And so it's really hard. And I think that's part of what's going on with Biden and the Democrats, why Biden's approval numbers are not very good, because everybody's just tired. They don't want this. They want, like, the 1920s, I guess, right? A return to normalcy, the way it was. But while the pandemic drags on and all this partisan fighting drags on, I think it just wears on everybody. And I agree with your messaging strategy. I'm just fearful that this fatigue just kind of covers everything and ends up hurting Democrats more, because we're the party in power.
Yeah. I think that is, that's something we all need to fear, because autocrats depend on that apathy. They depend on making people weary. These people are committed to lies. They're committed to distorting the truth, creating an alternate reality. We're not dealing with normal partisans here. We're not having a normal politics as usual discussion here. We are dealing with completely different realities, and their reality cannot be allowed to stand because we get tired of it, or we're going to pay a price. We're going to pay a price that we can't come back from. If the elections in 2022, if Republicans get control of, if they had complete control in Michigan or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin in 2020, we would have had a constitutional crisis unlike the one that probably would have toppled the government if we would have sent different slates of electors from states to Washington. We would have had a crisis unlike anything, including the Civil War, when it comes to the legitimacy of the American government. And that's where we're headed. They're not going to make the same mistakes in 2024 that they made in 2020 if they can win in 2022. Those are the stakes. That's why we need to stay vigilant and try to, let people take a little snooze during 2021, those who didn't have an election, but in the states. But next year, they've got to wake up. They've got to be mobilized, got to vote. It's for all the marbles. These next two elections are going to be crazier than the last two. Let's be realistic about it.
There's no question.
Author and former Ohio Democratic Party Chair David Pepper joins the conversation after these messages on A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Joining the discussion this week is my good friend David Pepper, former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party and author of the new book, Laboratories of Autocracy. David is a lawyer, writer, political activist, former elected official, and adjunct professor, and he served as the chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party in 2015 and 2021. In that role, he was engaged in numerous fights and extensive litigation over voter suppression and election laws in the Buckeye State. Stemming from that work, David appeared in All In, the documentary highlighting Stacey Abrams' nationwide fight for voting rights.
Pepper has written four novels that bridge real-world politics and fiction, including A Simple Choice, forthcoming from Putnam in June of 2022. His first novel, The People's House, earned praise for having predicted the Russian scandal. The Wall Street Journal named Pepper one of the best political thriller writers on the scene. David earned his BA magna cum laude from Yale University, where he was Phi Beta Kappa, and later earned his JD from Yale Law School. David also teaches election and voting rights law as an adjunct professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. Welcome to a republic if you can keep it.
David, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. Why don't we start out by what I'm interested in, frankly. Tell us about your book and your study of the autocratic movements that are going on, not just in Michigan and Ohio, but elsewhere. Love to hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert, but I know enough to be dangerous. And I know enough to know that what's happening in our state houses is a lot closer to what's happening in some other countries than most people, you know, are understanding. And I worry somehow that because it's in our own country, we don't see these steps combined for the truly foreboding, you know, direction they are. But if it were another country, we'd actually see it. We'd say, oh, my gosh, you know, a country that is rigging all its legislative districts. So even the minority wins, even when it doesn't get the same, you know, when it gets fewer votes, they're attacking courts. They're attacking, you know, protests by their opposition, you know, on and on and on. If that was another country, we would probably issue sanctions or, you know, think some states have literally said you can run over a protester without liability. If another country, if Putin demanded that, we would literally be outraged. And here it's happening in our states. And I just think we don't like it, but we don't think of it the same way. And so I try and draw the analogy to other countries. I try and draw upon academics who studied competitive autocracies, which is what these are. And it's also very reminiscent of how Jim Crow started in America. It was the same type of nonstop attack on democracy in southern state houses. You know, Ulysses Grant and others fought it, but at a certain moment they stopped fighting, and we all know what happened. You can't stop fighting when one side is relentlessly attacking democracy.
I think you're exactly right. I tweeted about this last night after yet another one of Donald Trump's delusional facts statements came out again, talking about the attempted coup was November 3rd, blah, 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 like he does. And we've kind of become just kind of numb to the fact that one of the two leading contenders to be the next president of the United States is engaged in this sustained, deliberate, not, you know, tireless assault on the foundations of democracy. And it doesn't even get news anymore.
Yeah.
It's just kind of taken with a grain of salt. Yet this is what we're going to be facing in 2023 and 2024. And if the 2022 elections that are going to be run in these gerrymandered districts and in the congressional districts and in the state legislative districts, if they go the way that it looks like they're going to go, God help us.
Yeah, it's exactly the case. And, you know, I think we're sort of getting used to, you know, what Trump did, what January 6th was. But even worse to me is that we are also let fly under the radar the fact that the work being done in these state houses in the end I believe, is more dangerous than people charging the Capitol. Because the people charging the Capitol, it was, you know, the appearance of it was, you don't do that in America. It looked illegitimate, right? And it was stopped. Well, in the state houses, they are acting, let's say, abnormally is a nice way of putting it. This is not normal politics that they're undertaking in these state houses. But to the average person, it looks normal. The hearing today I spoke at looked legitimate. They are rigging these districts so they would only lose 2 out of 15 in a state that's close to 50-50, as if that's normal. And so I worry, and this is what a competitive autocracy is. This is Orban in Hungary, you know, Tucker Carlson's favorite leader. The more dangerous thing is in state houses, they are doing all these things in a way that will down the road feel legitimate. And so if these state houses, you know, that I'm forgetting his name now. It was Eastman who wrote the memo. Those memos are going to all these state houses. They're in the middle of, I'm sure, already thinking, what can we do to change the elector system in our states? And if they get ahead of it in a way they didn't in 20, it'll have the trappings of legitimacy. So longer term, I worry even more that we're not going fast enough on the January 6th investigation. They've got to move faster. But below the surface, even of that, the danger in these state houses, I think, is even worse. It's totally under the radar. And every once in a while, the national media freaks out because of that ridiculous Texas law the other week, the Georgia voting law where you couldn't pass out water. We have a momentary, you know, collective, oh my gosh, what's happening? And then we go back to the debt limit debate or something else. There's never sustained attention that there needs to be, you know, pardon my French, what the hell is going on in these state houses? Why? What's the cause of it? How do we stop it? We take it for a given they're going to be doing this. The minute you accept it and take it as a given that they're undemocratic and you can't do anything about it, they just won. Because it means they're always on offense, there's never any accountability, and you're stuck playing defense half the time. You'll win some court cases, you'll lose others. But if they're on offense all the time, and we're on defense part of the time and never on offense, again, the history in other countries, the history in our own country is the folks attacking democracy nonstop will win that battle. And we have to really focus on the big stuff in the Capitol, but also really start to get to these state houses and figure out, from federal legislation down to local activism, how do we start pushing back a lot harder than we have?
David, do you see any examples in the states, you know, there may be Democrats, independents, nonpartisan groups, they may be conscientious Republicans like my friend Jeff, who are effectively pushing back?
How
to do this?
Sadly, one of the best examples on the state house level was that Virginia was able to flip a gerrymandered state house over the last decade. Now, we have the bigger sort of cycles, and we can all read Virginia. You know, it's a pretty standard outcome that it flips away from the presidency. But over the course of the decade, Virginia did a very nice job. Very few state houses changed against the gerrymander from the beginning of the decade. Virginia ran more candidates than ever run. They ran more than the Republicans did. And over multiple cycles, they flipped their state house. And it's still, I think, 50-50. Obviously, Stacey Abrams is a wonderful case study. And one of the things that we have to think about that we often don't, and Jeff, maybe because you're a Republican, you can tell us, well, the other side is better at this. It's a long game. It's a long game for democracy. Democrats often judge everything on the last cycle, and we don't stick with the plan. And Stacey Abrams, who I happen to be friends with from law school, I know what she's been doing for a decade. Long before she ever ran for governor of Georgia, she was registering voters in Georgia as a state house member. Register, 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 fight suppression, run for governor, lose, keep fighting, keep fighting, keep building. She said after her election, this was progress. Now, most Democrats would say, what do you mean you lost? She said, no, we made progress. We registered more people voted. Every one of those people will vote in 20. It's all additive. And so what happens? Georgia turns blue. We win the Senate through Georgia because she knew it was a long game. And we all have to start thinking about it as a long game. That's why we're going to, just like in Michigan, we need to run in every district. Most of those people are going to lose. But everyone running in every district is part of building. It's part of registering. It's part of changing the argument versus silence, which is what the other side wants. They don't want any opposition to gerrymandered districts. They don't want people to know that they vote against infrastructure that could have helped their small town. So we have to think about it in a long game. And I go through that in my book. And Stacey Abrams is the best example of someone who said, reviving democracy in Georgia is a long struggle, and I'm fighting it in a long struggle. I'll see progress even at down times, and look what happens. And we have to do that everywhere. Those are just some. There are other examples, too. I mean, we've had some in Ohio. I mean, going from a 7-0 Supreme Court only 3 years ago to a 3-3 Supreme Court with a Chief Justice who's a moderate, massive change, even in how the current gerrymandering is going to play out. We did that under the radar. We did that with focus. We were very, even when Biden said he wasn't going to come here in the end, basically, they didn't say it, but it was clear the money wasn't there. We said, well, we don't care. We're going to win the Supreme Court race. We won it by 10 points. So we've had successes too. Focus on all the positions that wield some leverage over democracy and go win as many as you can, even if they're not a swing Senate race that everyone in the country is paying attention to.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. The long game is key. And, you know, I have a unique story when it comes. I'm the somebody who's actually gerrymandered plans. I've drawn the plans in 2001 and 2011. I was involved in drawing plans back as far as 1991. In the 1980s, smart Republicans like Spence Abraham, who went on to the U.S. Senate, Bob LeBrant and others looked at the long game, and they weaponized redistricting in the state, in the state house. They financed it. They weaponized it, and we used it to our advantage for 30 years. I was part of that. I'm one of the few people who's willing to talk about that. But at the time, you know, I can tell you, we didn't think we were, you know, wearing black hats and subverting democracy. But I see that now the role that redistricting and gerrymandered districts that where whoever is elected, be it Republican or Democrat, if they have to answer only to a primary electorate, a small turnout primary, you get skewed, you get these polarized situations that fall, that they start to push outside of normal partisan behavior. We expect partisan behavior. That's normal. But when we get into the extreme, when we get into the radical, when we get into the violent, that's where we are now. And that's where the wheels come off of everything.
Yeah. And you know, you're very similar to John Kasich. John Kasich, after a couple of years as governor, figured out, my gosh, the real problem here is the state house and Jim Jordan and people like him. Who drew the maps? John Kasich. My guess is he regretted that he did it, but And we had other moderates, John Husted, same thing. John Boehner was the guy getting all the info to the people drawing the congressional maps. And what I say in my book is, again, without excusing it, I don't think even Kasich or Boehner or Karl Rove, even, who was part of that whole 09 effort to win these key positions, could see how much more warped politics would be with the following I'm going to describe. We are now at the end of a first generation of state house majorities who themselves have never really experienced democracy in their rise to power. They just haven't literally, if you go in my book, I go through the numbers. There are 99 seats in Ohio. The Republicans always have somewhere in the mid 60s. 50 of those 99 seats average a 20-point victory over a decade. The next 10 averaged a double-digit victory. So we're not talking about 30 people in seats they can never lose. We're talking about the whole majority. And so these are people who themselves have literally never experienced any kind of broad democratic system in their rise to power. And here's what they figured out. And this is why they didn't like my testimony today, because I kind of told them this. The one thing they realized, now outside of a primary, so they go as extreme as possible, but they figured out if we are thrown into a district that isn't all like independent and close, we're done for. Not only have we never really run for an office in a real contested race, but what we've had to do to survive in this gerrymandered world is be so extreme that we would never survive in a world of close districts. So they have all the incentive to keep robust democracy from never happening, because it would literally be the end of their power. So I think more so in the past, where there'd be gerrymandering, but it would flip back and forth. You know, Ohioans flipped the House in 2008, despite a gerrymandered 01. But this current generation, the kind that I spoke to today, almost, I went through the numbers just to see who I was speaking to, almost none of them has actually been in a real election. It's foreign to their own experience. You know, I'll just give my own history. I ran for county commission, Hamilton County, 50-50. I had to hustle. I had a Republicans for Pepper group, Jeff. I wasn't embarrassed about that. I told everyone about it. I needed to win over Republicans, Democrats, and I won. That's a certain type of politics. They've never experienced that. They're scared of it. And they pretty much know that they would lose if they were in that world. And here's the problem. They're the ones who write the rules of the system in these state houses. So we got a bunch of people afraid of democracy who essentially set the rules of democracy. As I write in the book, how's that going to turn out? They're doing everything they can to never be held accountable.
And we have this system with no uniformity across the country. We have these independent or citizens commissions or bipartisan commissions in some state that all have their rules. We have Republicans in some states, Democrats in others. There's 50 different sets of rules that determine who goes to Congress, who goes to the state capitals. And that is bad for democracy, in my view. I think that there needs to be some kind of federal uniformity, not only to protect access to voting, but to prevent these the manipulation, the putting your thumb on the scale when it comes to who how these lines are drawn and how representation is determined.
I couldn't agree more. You know, sometimes I'm on a Republican show and they think a trick question is, well, what about Illinois? My answer is gerrymandering is bad everywhere. It leads to poor government. It leads to corruption. If you're not accountable, like the wheels fall off, it's pretty much endemic. But I do think I sympathize with states. You know, they're watching Ohio and Texas. So the Illinois Democrats or New York Democrats are like, well, if we don't do it, then we're losing. So how do you prevent a race to the bottom? National standards. If you set an equal playing field at the federal level, then everyone will behave better. If you don't, you're going to have a race to the bottom. With computer mapping and everything else, that race to the bottom is getting more brutal every 10 years. Here's the thing that I think I try and get. I try not to get too much into the law part. I tried to make this book accessible. But I think the founders would be horrified by what we're seeing. You know, if you remember the Constitution, there's a lot of famous clauses, but there's a forgotten clause called the Guarantee Clause. And the Guarantee Clause, and again, I'm an adjunct professor. I don't want to claim to be a true academic. But the Guarantee Clause is basically saying the federal government will guarantee a Republican form of government in states. And when they said Republican form of government, we know what they meant. They meant where the people were sovereign. The will of the people will be reflected in state government. I mean, this was not just sort of a suggestion. It said the federal government shall guarantee, meaning in their recent history, they were worried that state governments could get taken over by it. They thought of monarchical interests or big fancy elitists, and they worried about that. So they literally wrote a clause. We, the federal government, shall guarantee that states will essentially be democratic, as we say today, democratic, you know, runs places. Exactly what the founders worried about is happening, that states would be, you know, ALEC and all this other stuff, that states would become, you know, as sort of the Achilles heel of American governance. They're very susceptible to being taken over by these outside interests. It's exactly what the founders worried about. And this is my argument against the filibuster. The founders would say, filibuster, are you not reading the part where we guaranteed democratic governance at state level? You're supposed to solve that, Congress. And of course, the filibuster should not be in the way of what essentially was a guarantee we made in the Constitution. So it really is, you know, I think when you get to it, there needs to be federal standard. Of course there does. That's the most powerful solution, just like after the Civil War, just like in the 60s, the most powerful solution to attacks on democracy at the state level is the federal government coming in to stop it. Now, there's a lot of things we can do and have to do. But if the federal government doesn't play the role even the founders guaranteed they would play, it makes everyone else's work close to impossible to stop the problem.
So it sounds like you are a big supporter of some of the elements that we've seen in federal legislation, right?
I am. I think there's a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of good stuff in there, and And the worry is, you know, the Supreme Court has taken a baseball bat to the Voting Rights Act. But they also, one of the interesting things, and I'm teaching my voting rights course, and so I'm going through all the cases at the same time I'm talking about the book so much. The Supreme Court has never agreed that you can sue about a partisan gerrymander. That was that Wisconsin case from a couple years ago. You can sue if there's clear racial discrimination. But if someone says, oh, I was just being really partisan, the court has always said, that's not something, that's a political question. We won't look at that. But what they've also always said in those decisions was, but Congress has the power to do something about it. They have said that. And the answer is, we'll go do it right now. Even Justice Scalia said Congress has the power to do something about gerrymandering, even though the court won't get into it. So Congress needs to take that up. And again, you know, I have just zero patience for the idea that the filibuster should get in the way of an attempt to protect democracy itself. That just doesn't make any sense. We can talk about, you know, there have been hundreds of carve outs. I can't think of a more, you know, logical carve out, if you read the Constitution and our history, than protecting democracy itself. And again, the Supreme Court has said, oh, yeah, Congress has a clear role by the Constitution and able to deal with gerrymandering with the kind of standards Jeff was talking about. And that's in the bill.
Now, it sounds like, David, as I've been listening to you, it struck me that what we've got going on in these states is the creation of a one-party state, like we see in many countries around the world, in what looks like a two-party state, right? A two-party system. Yeah. It's got all the trappings, all the facade of that. But in actuality, as you point out, it's a one-party state, and people continue to pass laws and do things to insulate themselves from going back to a legitimate two-party state. That's a very unique and, I think, insightful analysis of what we're seeing going on in these states. And you're absolutely right about gerrymandering. You know, we've seen here in Michigan, you've seen in Ohio, where people just have to survive an extremist primary, both parties, and then the general election is a walkover. So they've never really faced competition. They've never really had to go out and campaign, and they are scared to death of what could happen if they actually had to compete among general election voters to get reelected.
With records that they have built up that are extreme as can be. And we had last week in Ohio, for example, a lot of these anti-mask candidates running for school board. They sound exactly like the state reps. Most of them lost. They lost because school voters were like, we don't want that in our schools. These state reps wouldn't know that because in their districts in the primary, they would win. But it just, if you throw that extremism, you know, school districts aren't gerrymandered. They're the schools, the boundaries. You throw that extremism into even school districts in red areas. These, you know, big money backed anti-mask people, without any real organized opposition, by the way, mostly got crushed because they just were so off the wall. They were yelling at meetings. People, kids, you know, I have young kids. They don't mind wearing masks. They don't even think about it. And so it just shows you throw their politics into anything looking like normal districts, and most of them aren't going to last very long. And I believe they know that. And so the ones who are drawing these maps know it for sure. And they're going to keep doing that. And you mentioned again, competitive autocracy. It relies on the appearance of elections that we go through, and we do. And you know, I think when they are truly attacking the heart of these elections, that's why we have to say this is not just a law about protests. It's a law undermining democracy itself. And we have to call it out as such because they don't want it to seem that bad. We call it out when it's in Hungary, but here's an example. In Ohio, they are now changing the way that we elect courts. Why? Because we were winning, as I described. So what's the legislature do? Threatened by a check and balance in independent court, they passed a law requiring that party ID be on every court race. So they're basically trying to gerrymander the very court that oversees their laws. That's right out of Putin's Russia, folks. That's Hungary. That is trying to cherry pick judges. that's the check and balance on you. And so that is, again, that's a norm breaking attack on democracy that hardly got a headline in Ohio. But that's what they're doing here. And they did that in North Carolina. All over the country, they are trying to figure out ways to change the makeup of state courts that are a threat to one party rule through the legislature and normally governor's offices.
David, do you think the campaign finance system is a part of this? I mean, you talked about the founders and the guarantee clause. They never could have envisioned the amount of money that's being spent in our current system. And again, that can be developed into an incumbent protection system, right? The way you set up the campaign finance laws and so forth. So in your mind, is that an element?
It's part of it. I did not get into that in my book as much because that's so covered by, you know, some great people like Jane Mayer. There's no doubt a massive amount of money holding up the entire statehouse framework. I mean, again, you poke much at almost any of these major efforts on voter suppression, on ALEC, and you see the same big players behind funding. But here's the truth. Most of the campaigns are over because of the district, the shape. I mean, it's not as if they need that much money to win a district that's a 70-30 district. So now a lot of the campaign money is going to the infrastructure that keeps it all in place, you know, flying these people to conferences. You know, so you would know this, I assume all your listeners do. They basically privatized the legislation process. They're flying these legislators all over the country to conferences and spoon feeding them law, you know, quote unquote, model laws on everything from, you know, telecom to energy to for-profit schools. And then they fly back home and they all pass it. And so there's a lot of money into all of that. These legislators don't need as much money to get reelected because of gerrymandering, but all the millions that go into all that other stuff is all by the same people. I'm a big campaign finance reform advocate. In the world of things that I can be, that I think can be fixed in the near term, given the makeup of the court, that's one of the toughest. So in my book, I'm trying to focus. And I, by the way, one other good thing that's happening in politics, the ability of people to give money, small dollar online, is giving candidates a way to fight back. And now it's happening at the bigger level. We have to figure out how to also allow statehouse candidates to get a lot of low dollar online giving. But I do think that is a revolution. That's a good thing. And it's helping even the play. You know, Jamie Harrison did not lose to Lindsey Graham because of money. Jamie raised $160 million. So there is an ability through this sort of democratizing of fundraising through small dollar donations. It's helping some. So I get more into some of these deeper structural issues that I don't think people are as focused on. But yeah, it's a part of the whole problem.
One thing I saw you talk about, switching gears a little bit from just the concept of democracy and getting people to care about that, was the economic cost. You, on a recent tweet, took people on a tour around Manchester, Ohio, and showing the real world economic cost of that. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, because I think, you know, hitting people in their wallets, having them recognize how this hurts them was a very astute way to portray it.
Absolutely. I think, and this is one of the hardest things to communicate long term, but these rigged districts, I think, are crushing small towns and rural places like Ohio, crushing them. And when I went to, so Manchester is a small town about 40 miles along the river from where I am in Cincinnati. And if you went to it, I mean, when I go there, my blood boils. It's just so depressing that in America, in 2021, we are letting communities with the potential of being near a river. You know, there's a lot you could do with that. That main street is as depressing a thing as you've ever seen. It's a ghost town. Most of the buildings are empty and worse. And the legislators from this district, the congressman, Brad Winstrup, who I mentioned in the book a bunch, the state house, they vote, including the other day on infrastructure, they vote against the exact things that these towns need to actually try and compete in the 21st century. Broadband, infrastructure, healthcare. These towns have had huge opioid crisis hit. They need treatment. And I believe a central reason that these people are voting against their interests is, again, because they know they're never going to lose. And I give the example in the book, and this is a true story. You know, I cite the newspaper story where the journalist dug this up. the people of Manchester, seeing their town implode into nothing, called up their state senator who had voted against their interests on all these issues. It's in Ohio. They literally, this was a Kasich thing. They are taking money from small town budgets to give out as tax cuts at the high end that never trickle down back to these towns. So Manchester's already struggling. The state's taking some of their money to give to in order to pay for tax cuts. So they're literally reverse Robin Hooding small towns. So these citizens said to the state senator, our town's collapsing. Let's meet. Most citizens wouldn't even know to do that. They get them to the meeting. They say, our town's collapsing. What should we do? And he says to them, sometimes you just have to move. Think about that. You know, this is supposed to be elected democracy. If you're failing as a politician, you move. You go to some other job. You don't get to tell the people in your district that they move unless you're in a world where you're not accountable, where you're so confident in your rigged district that not only are you thinking they should move, you actually tell them that. And when the journalist called up this guy and said, did you really tell them that? He said, I did. And so it just shows you there's a connection between, you know, there's a connection between corrupt and rigged legislators and these small towns. And here's the other thing I'd say about it. Endemic to these corrupt, these rigged legislatures are basically these places have become massive pay to play operations. And, you know, in Ohio, it's been energy companies cutting deals to get bailouts. It's been a ridiculous for-profit charter school scam that didn't even take attendance while it was ripping, you know, hundreds of millions out of public schools. They're never held accountable for public outcomes because they can't lose. But the consistent trend is money is going from public assets to private. And that is directly correlates to the downfall of these communities. Their money is being raided as the people who represent them fatten up the people giving up the big money in a state house like Columbus. So it's literally what you'd expect if you start figuring out how it really works. So you guys are from Michigan. I know we have a rivalry, but I think we'd all admit Ohio's a hell of a state. We're the home of John Glenn and Toni Morrison and the Wright brothers. And by the way, Michigan's a great state too. Don't tell anyone in Ohio I said that. So it should make our blood boil in Ohio that this great state, if you look at almost any public outcome, is plummeting. Healthcare, we're in the 40s. Education, we were fifth 12 years ago. We're now in the mid-20s. You know, big companies leaving. We had one of the worst population numbers in terms of slow growth of any state in the country. The gerrymandered rigged state houses are directly leading to horrible public outcomes. It's playing out of big cities and small towns. But in those small towns, no one's explaining that problem to them, and we have to start. It's actually the way out of some of the problems with rural. We think we have problems in rural America as Democrats. Lifting democracy in those places would actually help us start doing better there.
Well, David, thank you so much for tying all that together. This has been a remarkable discussion, but we are going to have to wrap it up. We really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to reading your book. I haven't finished it yet. I've started it, but I'm looking forward to finishing the book. Tell our listeners real quick how they can find your book and read more.
Well, the easiest thing is just honestly going to Amazon there. You can also go to my website, laboratoriesofautocracy.com. And my only question or my only request is, and I really appreciate you doing this, the reason this all happens is no one knows anything about what we've just described. No one knows what these state houses. If you read the book and you find it compelling, get other people to read it or something like it, because people are in the dark about what's happening. And that's exactly why it is happening.
Right. Well, thank you for your insight. Thank you for your passion. I know you're not going to stop fighting. And it's so great to hear your analysis and your thoughts today. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
David, thanks a lot. And with that, we call this week's podcast to a close. Our great thanks to David Pepper for joining the conversation.
We love hearing from our listeners. Send us an email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com. And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. Thank you for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.